John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry today. John will be back later this week. But we'll begin today with a few apologies. Or are they? The president expressed some regret over the weekend for playing golf so soon after his remarks about the death of journalist James Foley at the hands of ISIS. There was another sorry from Bruce Levinson. He's the managing partner of the Atlanta Hawks basketball team, who became the second NBA owner in the last 5 months to give up his franchise over what he accepts were racially insensitive remarks. We'll talk about that later this hour, and we'll end not so much with an apology, more of a pardon. 40 years ago to the day, President Ford officially pardoned President Richard Nixon, and it's got us thinking about forgiveness. And of course, our door is open for anyone in the mood to forgive and forget.
Hi, this is Leah calling from Indian Rocks Beach, Florida. I recently forgave my husband for not dancing with me at our wedding because he was too nervous. We've been together 14 years.
We'll talk more about forgiveness and regret, and we'd love your stories, too. Our number is 8778-MY-TAKE. If you're on Twitter, you can follow us at The Takeaway. That's all one word, at The Takeaway.
Over the course of months, we are going to be able to not just blunt the momentum of ISIL, we are going to systematically degrade their capabilities, we're going to shrink the territory that they control, and ultimately we're going to defeat them.
Expect to hear a lot more from the president later this week, but his message over the weekend was clear when he was interviewed on Meet the Press on NBC. America should get ready for a lengthy campaign against ISIS. According to our partner, the New York Times, the White House says it could take 3 years to complete. It'll require a sustained effort that's likely to go beyond the president's term in office. Well, phase one is already underway. More than 140 airstrikes this past month. The next phase is due sometime after Iraq forms a more inclusive government, if that happens. This will involve an intensified effort to train, advise, or equip the Iraqi military, Kurdish Peshmerga fighters, and possibly members of Sunni tribes in Iraq. And finally, and probably most controversially, destroying the terrorist army in its sanctuary inside Syria. And that's something that could be years away rather than months. What's also clear, though, is how ISIS is tearing up some traditional rivalries in the Middle East. And it's this, according to Wesley Clark, the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO in Europe, that will be key to a successful campaign.
Well, let's be clear about what's happening with ISIS. ISIS is a creation of Saudi money, principally, and maybe some Qatari money, too, and extremist Sharia philosophy, and Ba'athist Sunni generals who have forged a military instrument that's a direct threat to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. It's using religious fervor as its motivating force. We don't want U.S. or Western ground troops involved in a religious struggle between Sunni and Shia Islam. The truth is, if you look at it through their eyes, the Saudis are fighting against the Shia hegemonial aspirations of Iran. But the Saudis themselves are vulnerable because their royal family and its thousands of members could be said to be not living in accordance with the strict monotheism, extremist Sharia interpretations of Islam. And that makes them vulnerable to charges of hypocrisy. And that means that perhaps their own population is not sufficiently loyal to provide them protection. That's the real threat posed by ISIS. Todd, you've referred several times to public opinion and public support. And yes, that's important. But if you look at the United States, our most successful presidents have shaped public opinion. They haven't been guided by it. And when they've been hamstrung by public opinion, it's often been proved that public opinion has been wrong about the wisest course of action. And I just want to return again to Iraq. I think we know now that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with the strikes on New York City in 9/11. Yet, at the time we invaded, a majority of the American public believed that he did. Some opinion polls at the time showed that 80% of the news media favored an American invasion of Iraq. So, citing public opinion, whether it's in a time of retrenchment or let's hurry up and take action against ISIS, as a reason to take action, as a guiding principle, it's dangerous in foreign policy.
Well, before we let you go, General, speaking of the liabilities of public opinion, what would it mean to Arab public opinion in these Sunni Arab states that you talk about to have the United States rhetorically or politically try to lead or organize a coalition of their governments against ISIS? It seems that we would have to do so extremely quietly. I don't think that the Saudis want our fingerprints on their action against ISIS if it were to take place.
Well, you know, in the last week, the Saudi leadership has met privately with the Qatari leadership. They flew in. There was no news about it in the press in the United States. We knew about it, of course, behind the scenes because they were trying to patch over their quarrel between two branches of Wahhabi Sunnism. And this week, the Saudis met actually with the Iranians because the Saudis and the Iranians agree that ISIS is a threat. And so maybe the reason that President Obama said he didn't have a strategy on ISIS is because he knew what was happening and he's waiting for the Saudis and the Iranians and the other Sunni powers in the region to form the coalition that we can support. I think that this is a case where the United States has to tread very, very carefully. It's true. It's a trade-off. The longer it takes to form the coalition, the longer it takes the United States to strike in Syria, the greater the chance that ISIS has to strengthen its hand. But haste makes waste in this case. We've got to get it right. To do it right, you've got to have the Saudis and the Qataris who helped form ISIS take the lead in crushing it. Let them take the lead and work it so we can support from as much behind the scenes as possible.
General Wesley Clark is a retired general of the U.S. Army, served as Supreme Allied Commander in Europe from 1997 to 2000. He is now Distinguished Fellow at the Burkle Center at UCLA. General Clark, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Back in June, as undocumented children streamed across the southern border, President Obama promised executive action on deportations by the end of the summer. And it wasn't the first time the president said he'd go around congressional Republicans and do what he can on immigration on his own with executive action. But politics is about priorities, and politics is about winning. And as tight races threaten Democrats' hold on the Senate this November, President Obama has decided to hold off on any of those executive actions on immigration until after the election. Well, for Christina Jimenez, co-founder and managing director of United We Dream, an anti-deportation activist group, the president's decision is a huge disappointment, and that's putting it mildly. And her group isn't alone. She joins us now from New York. Hi, Christina.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you? And I ask it because I'd like to know what your reaction was the other day when President Obama finally said no executive action on any of your issues until after the election.
Well, United We Dream and Dreamers or immigrant youth across the country are very outraged and disappointed at the decision of the president to delay executive action on deportations and keeping our families together. For us, this is another slap in the face and another broken promise for the Latino and immigrant community by him and many of the Democrats that pressure him to delay his decision, you know, picking politics over our lives and over our communities.
For anybody who thinks that this is a promise that was made, you know, 3 months ago or something at the beginning of the summer, not really the case. You've been dealing with the White House for how long?
Well, since the president was elected in 2008 when he was running his presidential campaign, he made a commitment and will rally Latino voters and the Latino community around his promise of delivering immigration reform. And, you know, he missed that opportunity when Democrats also were in charge of Congress.
Well, Christina Jimenez, if I'm working for the president, and I don't, but for the sake of this discussion, I would come to you and say, okay, but he doesn't control everything. Look, we passed comprehensive immigration reform out of the Senate, the body that we control, in 2009. We got lots of Republican votes for it. Hey, guys, I don't control the House Republicans. They don't even agree with each other. I haven't ignored you, but I can't invent a consensus on immigration.
What we are saying to the president, it's very simple. His administration has deported over 2 million people. Now, Congress did not give him a mandate to deport over 2 million people under his administration. That has been a choice that the president has made. And what United We Dream and immigrant youth and families have been advocating for is for the deportations that are tearing families apart to stop. Which is why, for us, is outraging that he is deciding to delay, because every day of inaction for our community, it means 1,100 deportations, which really translates into 1,100 families every day, as you and I speak, that will be torn apart by the current immigration policy.
Now, what about the alternative, Christina? Because, of course, the president would also say, look, it was Senate Democrats trying to hold on to their political lives in places like Arkansas and Louisiana and North Carolina who said, this is going to make it harder, Mr. President. If you do this, I might lose. Now, if Republicans take the Senate, Christina Jimenez, you're going to have an even worse time. Isn't it better to sort of hold on for another few months, as frustrating as that is, and have a chance of not losing the Senate altogether? That's the president's argument.
Our response is that, you know, the polling numbers and the numbers in all of the states that are up for November have been out there for a while. And the president came out on June 30th and publicly said that he will take action without further delay on administrative relief from deportation for immigrant communities.
But that was before Mary Landrieu and Mark Pryor and Kay Hagan and others begged him not to do it. They said, sorry, this is going to hurt us.
Yeah, and what we're saying is it's real for our communities as well. And the president had a big opportunity here to really address his legacy with the immigrant and Latino community, who now know him as the deporter in chief.
There's one last promise coming from the White House, or so it appears, Christina Jimenez, which is maybe the announcement will be later after the election, but any change the president makes will be the same deadline, the same effective date as now, so you're not really losing anything.
What we are saying, again, is that every day that we are waiting, we're losing more family members that could have benefited from the president taking action now. So we will continue to pressure the president and make sure that post-election, the president goes big and that we will make sure that he acts for our communities.
The urgency of immigration reform, or deportation reform more specifically, clashes with the midterm election, and Christina Jimenez is on the front lines of it. She's managing director of United We Dream. Ms. Jimenez, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we just heard from immigration activist Christina Jimenez about what the president's decision to delay executive action on deportations means for young dreamers. For more on the president's decision and the politics at play here, Fernando Pizarro, Washington correspondent for Univision. Fernando, hi.
Hi, Todd. Good to be with you.
And it's great to have you. You know, I played the role of presidential advisor with Christina Jimenez for a minute, and let me play it with you, stressing again, I don't work for the president. I never would. I'd be bad at it. But, hey, if I was meeting with Christina Pizarro and the other groups and I worked for the president, I might say, guys, this is politics. Grow up. If we lose the Senate, you get nothing. We have to prevent the Republicans from winning. This is the only chance Democrats have of holding on to the Senate.
I think you've got a point. The question here, and trying to play White House advisor, as you're saying, the question is, why did the White House, why did the president place himself and the White House itself in the position of setting a deadline of the end of the summer that nobody was technically asking for? The president on June 30th could have come out, just like he did with Vice President Biden on his side, and said, I will act by the end of the year. If that had been the case, you and I probably would not be talking about this this week. So the question is, the president set a deadline that many were not asking for. It is true that organizations like United We Dream and many other immigrant organizations and congressional Hispanic Democrats would have liked the White House to act yesterday on executive actions. However, political reality has hit the White House on this issue. But again, if the White House has just said we will act by the end of the year, maybe they would have kept Republicans and Democrats wondering if they were going to act before or after the elections. The hope was, obviously, that action on behalf of Hispanics and immigrants was going to energize the Latino vote. But apparently, there's polling that goes back and forth. Christina cited some polling, but there's other polling that says that maybe is going to energize the Republican base in a negative way for Democrats. It's going to make many Republicans angry who are already upset at President Obama making all these executive actions on different areas, and on immigration, they would be angered even further.
Yeah, well, so, Fernando Pizarro, you know, you said that it didn't make sense maybe for the White House to set that deadline in the first place. It reminds you of, like, drawing a red line in Syria last summer. You didn't have to do it. The expectation wasn't met, and now you look to some people like a failure.
I was reading a lot of analysis post-analysis on the decision or announcement on Saturday, and then the President Obama's interview on Meet the Press on Sunday, and about how many other big speeches we've seen from the administration, and then create big expectations for certain action, and then the administration has to backtrack. On this particular issue, again, I don't see the need, and I've talked about this with administration's officials over the week and off the record on why did this happen? Why did the White House set itself for an arbitrary deadline that was, considering what has happened, probably very unnecessary?
Well, as we look at the Senate races, Fernando Pizarro, that you're talking about, here's another thing that happened, is that Democratic candidates in Arkansas and North Carolina and Louisiana that don't have sizable Latino populations went to the White House and said, if you do this, it's going to hurt our chances of winning and hurt your chances of holding on to the Senate. It's only Mark Udall in Colorado, the only endangered Democrat who probably would have benefited because there's lots of Latino voters in his state. So it looks like the White House just went with the numbers, despite their bad planning here.
No, I totally agree with you. You have to add other senators. Bill Nelson from Florida, Al Franken from Minnesota have added their voices and their opinions on this issue. So basically, yes, even though the White House and the president may say that politics has nothing to do with this decision, I think it's written all over it.
Yeah, nobody believes
they're
that.
Concerned about what's going to happen in November.
On policy, Fernando Pizarro, one thing the White House has suggested, maybe as yet another consolation prize to the immigration groups, is that the effective date of a presidential action here might stay the same, just a later announcement. Hey, it would have been, you know, February 1st anyway. It still is. We're just going to announce it when Southern voters don't get mad.
That is correct. Any decision the White House makes, number one, is not contingent on any congressional approval. So he could make it at the end of this year, or he could make it next year. So in any case, if it's going to come through executive action, at any moment, the action will be probably be enacted and announced, and then immigrants will be able to sign up if there's anything that's going to benefit them. So you're right. I mean, obviously, the timing of this, it's probably not important from the policy point of view. Now, the immigrant communities and the immigrant organizations are claiming, as you've heard, that every day 1,100 families are split or 1,100 people are deported from the U.S., so that's why they see this with utmost urgency.
Before we let you go, Fernando Pizarro, really in terms of policy, this is about 2016, isn't it? It used to be about 2008, then it was about 2012. We're not going to really get there till 2016 on anything substantial on immigration.
When it comes to comprehensive immigration reform in Congress, I think you're probably right.
Yeah, Fernando Pizarro is Washington correspondent for Univision. Fernando, thanks for your expertise.
Thank you.
Well, after dealing with the saga of Donald Sterling, the NBA has another scandal on its hands involving another owner and his views on racial topics. Over the weekend, Atlanta Hawks owner Bruce Levinson announced he was selling his team prior to the conclusion of a league investigation into a 2012 email directed to his co-owners. Now, in that email, Levinson discusses ticket sales and implies that white fans were scared off from the black culture that had developed at Hawks games. Levinson self-reported the email this week along with an apology and effectively kicked himself out of the league. Well, here to talk to us about the culture of the Atlanta Hawks and to get some background on Levinson, we have Curtis Bunn, deputy editor at the Atlanta Black Star and longtime sports reporter. Hi, Curtis.
Todd, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. You know, when you read Levinson's email, on the one hand, it's clumsy language. Some of it's racially charged. A lot of it's stupid. On the other hand, he sounds like a business person being cold and calculating about who's coming to his games, who's buying his product, who isn't, and how to change his demo and make more money.
It does read that way, but obviously the more damaging and impactful comments are on race, and he recognizes it as well as anyone else. I guess maybe 2 years later he recognized it, but it's not even shocking. It's kind of surprising still, but not shocking, because Donald Sterling, one of the things that in his clumsy and weird way talked about, essentially he wasn't the only one who had feelings on race as an NBA owner. And this is sort of like his prophecy coming to fruition.
Well, what do you think happened here with Bruce Levinson? As I said, he self-reported this email and then he said, okay, I'm going to sell. Do you think he looked back at the Donald Sterling experience and said, no matter what I meant back then, I just don't want to go through that and it's curtains for me, so I'm going to get out ahead of it?
I would think so. It seems as if he's met with like an Olivia Pope or some kind of image consultant who indicated you got to get in front of this thing. It's going to come out. I don't know why it hadn't come out in 2 years, or maybe they even knew that someone was threatening them with the idea that they would release the email, and to get in front of it would be the way that they approached it, to attack it now and not have to react to it. It's interesting to me that the timing of it. It happened obviously before the season started, but it also happened during the NFL opening weekend of the season. It is a football culture first in the South. And so it has pretty much been swallowed up among all this hoopla around the NFL season starting. And I wonder what will happen as the week progresses and it settles down about the Falcons around Tuesday and Wednesday, and people start really looking at this, because it hasn't been the topic of much conversation to this point.
Well, Curtis Bunn, another owner leaves the NBA in disgrace, but, you know, disgrace is a funny word when Donald Sterling sold his team or was part of a sale for $2 billion. What are the Hawks worth?
They're not worth anywhere near the LA Clippers were. They're near the middle to bottom rung.
But Levinson's going to make a lot of money, right?
He's going to make a lot of money. He's worth net worth right now at $500 million. And he's a guy, you know, the Hawks have had a peculiar ownership situation for years. He took over in 2004. They got rid of one owner. No one really knows about who these guys are. They're somewhat invisible, and yet no one's ever had a really good, warm feeling about them. And this really further cements their reputation here.
Do you think Bruce Levinson makes more money selling after this weekend than he would have made if he sold a year ago?
Probably so. It's hard to say. The Hawks are an enigma. A good team that makes the playoffs, I think 18th in the league in attendance, have a brand new arena, a relatively new arena in a great area downtown, which was really strange when he was talking about fans being afraid to come downtown. So I think the Hawks have value, and the value of the team certainly has increased since he's become the owner. So he will, you know, I think you said it right. They may be disgraced, but they'll be disgraced with their bank accounts swollen quite a bit.
Gilded disgrace, let's call it that. Curtis Bunn, deputy editor of the Atlanta Black Star. Curtis, thank you.
Thank you.
My conscience tells me clearly and certainly that I cannot prolong the bad dreams that continue to reopen a chapter that is closed.
Today, 40 years ago.
Now, therefore, I, Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States, pursuant to the pardon power conferred upon me by Article 2, have granted, and by these presents do grant, a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon.
President Gerald Ford issues his pardon of Richard Nixon there. A month before, Ford said, the long national nightmare of Watergate was over. But it wasn't until 3 years after that that Richard Nixon himself made his first formal public apology to the nation in a 1977 interview with David Frost. Listen.
I let down my friends. I let down the country. I let down our system of government and the dreams of all those young people that ought to get into government but will think it's all too corrupt and the rest.
Of course, that apology from Richard Nixon there came years after the pardon, after Nixon's crimes had already been forgiven, at least legally. But it got us thinking about this notion of forgiveness, public forgiveness versus private forgiveness, and what it really means to forgive and to move on.
This is Pat calling from Dallas, Texas. I forgave my father at age 35 for being a lifelong alcoholic. Shortly thereafter, he quit drinking and has been sober and a mentor for the last 27 years.
Well, joining me now from our partner at WGBH in Boston is Charles Griswold. He's professor of philosophy at Boston University and co-editor of Ancient Forgiveness, Classical, Judaic, and Christian. Professor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you're not a political scientist, and you don't have to be, but you are an expert on forgiveness. We just played the pardon from Gerald Ford. As an instrument of forgiveness, did it work?
Well, I don't think that pardon is an instrument of forgiveness. I think that pardon and forgiveness are two different notions. They're in the same family of concepts, and they overlap in some ways, but they also differ importantly.
Well, isn't a pardon a form of institutional forgiveness? I mean, Ford said the country needs to move on, needs to get past things. It doesn't mean that all the voters were not mad anymore, but as a governmental instrument or a political cultural instrument, I suppose, is the question.
I wouldn't refer to it as an instrument of forgiveness, although forgiveness is sometimes used in political or judicial contexts. I think a lot is to be gained by keeping these notions distinct and separate from each other.
Well, if it's not forgiveness, what is it then?
Well, it's pardon exercised under the authority granted by the Constitution, as President Ford said, Article 2, Section 2. But as you also noted, it doesn't involve, for example, the giving up of anger or resentment on the part of those who were harmed. And that is one of the ways in which pardon differs from forgiveness.
That's an important ingredient, that anger or desire or like the right of revenge is given up.
I think so. I mean, in what I would call the model or the paradigm case of forgiveness, the case in which the heart of the matter is best illustrated, forgiveness is interpersonal. It involves two people, one of whom has wronged the other. And forgiveness is in part a moral and spiritual response by the victim to the wrongdoer that is offered in light of steps that the wrongdoer takes, among other things. And I would also argue that for forgiveness to come off fully, the victim must also not only moderate his or her anger or resentment, to use an older term, but also commit to letting go of any lingering resentment.
And is that really the point, so that resentments or animosities don't linger for generations? I mean, I was kind of thinking about forgiveness in terms of, you know, if we all lived in a village or something, and I kind of thought, well, what's the point? If you wrong me and I forgive you, is it for me so I can feel better? Is it for our village so that you and I aren't at war forever? I mean, what's the point of even having it?
I don't think the point is primarily utilitarian, so to speak. It's not about, in the first instance anyways, the greater good, although, in fact, it may redound to the greater good. And I also don't think that forgiveness is fundamentally a therapeutic issue. It's not about making yourself feel less of the toxic anger, although that is a consequence of it, and it's a good consequence of it. But I don't think that that's the point of it. The relation between the victim and the offender is a moral relation, and what's going on in forgiveness, I think, is in part a holding responsible of the offender by the victim. And this is connected with the steps that I think the offender should take, at least in the ideal case, to really be worthy of forgiveness. And it's also about the affirmation of certain kinds of moral ideals. And these ideals are ideals of reconciliation, of peace, of spiritual growth on the part of the individuals, and of the possibility of a kind of new start, of, if you like, a rebirth.
Professor Charles Griswold from Boston University, you know, we could spend an hour or more talking about the different kinds of forgiveness and how to do it and why it's important, and even about religious forgiveness. But we do have to touch on that, because I think as we have this discussion, so many people think about their religious traditions of forgiveness. And you know, there's been a lot of writing suggesting that some of the religious forms of forgiveness take the Christian form, vicarious redemption or acknowledging a sin against God gets you forgiven, that it actually has an immoral element to a lot of people. You can't have your responsibility taken away by just saying sorry or just going in a confession booth or some other form. Is there some truth to that, do you think?
Well, a lot depends on here on exactly how you understand the relevant theology. But given the sorts of assumptions you were just making, I think that there is a worry that forgiveness will collapse into excuse. And in order to be forgiven, I would submit that one has to take certain kinds of steps that go beyond a kind of insincere, I'm sorry. One also has to be sincere about that, and one has to take responsibility and really apologize and repudiate what you did and become the kind of person who won't do that again, or at least commit to becoming that kind of person. Otherwise, it's hollow and it's no longer a virtue. In the case of the religious conception that you were just sketching, there is a concern that you're let off the hook, or you might be let off the hook a bit too easily.
Forgiveness and the notion of it is complicated and gray and has a long history, and we just wanted to touch on it a little bit with Charles Griswold. And it seems that no matter what form of forgiveness you subscribe to, doing the work to get to forgiveness, both for yourself and for somebody who's wronged you, is really the most important part. Right, Professor?
I would agree with that entirely. And I would add that that's one of the reasons why I'm quite skeptical of the notion of unilateral or unconditional forgiveness, where the victim simply forgives the offender regardless of what the offender does. That seems to me to be very close to simply excusing the offender or letting the offender off the hook.
Charles Griswold is professor of philosophy at Boston University. He's co-editor with David Constant of Ancient Forgiveness, Classical, Judaic, and Christian. Professor, forgive me for making you hang on the radio for so long.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, President Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon 40 years ago today. Who have you forgiven lately? Your take, please, on 8778MyTake. We're addicted to Twitter, too. Of course, we read them all at The Takeaway. By the way, this week, Henry Kissinger, former Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, will be on the program. Can't promise more on the subject of forgiveness, maybe, but the politics will definitely be fascinating. You know, Yogi Berra said it's hard to make predictions, especially about the future. Well, we're going to welcome author Matthew Burroughs to talk about his book, The Future Declassified. Matt Burroughs will be our guide. Some hard-nosed thoughts about tech, the climate, pandemics, and a range of other future scenarios. A reminder, it's all at thetakeaway.org, including our podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo.com, offering business cards with Printfinity, the option for a different image on every card in a pack. More at Moo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.